So as you recall, I hope, yes, they were speaking about happiness. Whatever it is, beg for it, borrow it, or steal it. The desperate quest of the conditioned soul. And our theme yesterday was that, our theme in particular yesterday was that happiness is a mental concoction. Something imagined in the mind. It's like a bunch of bees buzzing in your bonnet, so to speak. And you just become obsessed. I don't know if you've ever... Yes, I'm sure you can remember some kind of bee or wasp buzzing around you, or even a fly. The flies here can be a bit bothersome if they're in a room with you. And they just buzz around you and you can't get rid of the insect. Well, the quest for happiness is like that. It's not this... Hope for happiness actually is not so near and dear to you as you think, because you're a spirit soul meant to cooperate in Krishna's pleasure, and Krishna's pleasure is perpetual and unlimited. So we get these concocted ideas in our mind from the Manodharma factory, the factory of mental speculation. Yes, happiness is mentally speculated. Mentally fabricated. We discussed yesterday also how even mundane social scientists have now understood in the past 10 years that people cannot accurately project the emotions or the so-called happiness they'll feel from a future event, nor can they accurately predict the distress they'll feel from a future event. Studies have been made about lottery winners. And at first there's a great euphoria that we won the lottery. Just like in the USA half a year ago. A man won the lottery for $1 million. And then a month later, he won the lottery again for $2 million. The mathematical chances of even winning once are ridiculously so tiny. And then to win twice? And I looked at his face, a picture of his face, and unfortunately, the face looked very dry. He said, I'm going to make my house bigger. He lived there with just his wife. No extended family due to so many previous divorces. And so scientists have discovered that the euphoria that you get from even a huge event like winning the lottery or $1 million or more very soon fades and you settle back to your normal humdrum level of quote-unquote happiness. Try to think about it. There's some kind of, the game is rigged. There's some kind of ceiling that no matter what you do, you can't materially rise above that ceiling. So these hopes we have, I'm going to do this and be happy. I can just see it now. All I want for Christmas, all I need for Christmas are my two front teeth. And we talked about how, as an adult, that chant turns into, all I want for Christmas are two gold teeth. The same principle. Projecting falsely. Because your senses are imperfect. So many of you can remember, at least I remember, because you come and tell me, all I need is this and I'll be happy. And then I notice, a few years down the track, the same thing that you wanted, if you did get it, you later complain about. So there's something going on in the mind. This mental concoction. So we heard from Krishna's statements in Bhagavad Gita. We heard from Bhagavatam, from the Python Man, how happiness is imagination. I know these are radical points. How happiness is mentally concocted. Nevertheless, the Bhagavatam is so complete that you can look at happiness from yet another angle. Besides being mentally concocted, it's also something that is packed into your body, whatever body you have at the time of birth. So you've got two things going on we're going to find today. They're very closely related. Or you could say it's the same thing looked at from different angles. Happiness is a mental concoction, and happiness as a psychophysical phenomenon that's packed in with the particular type of body you have and brought to you by time. So today we'll focus on that aspect. And hopefully by the end of this series of discussions, you'll be a happiness expert. You won't be victimized. Very beautiful phrase Prabhupada has in Bhagavad Gita. Amazing, because English wasn't his first language. Referring to material existence as chained victimization. The chains of victimization go from one birth to the next birth to the next birth. So you can just feel the chains of victimization around you and composing your body and mind. That is accurate vision. So, let us go to today's verse. A very famous verse for me, spoken by Prahlad Maharaj. After we chant it, I'll explain why it is famous for me. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 6, Text 3. Sukham Indriyakam Daitya.
Sukham Indriyakam Daitya.
Deha Yogena Dehina.
Deha Yogena Dehina.
Sarvachat Labhyate Daiva.
Sarvachat Labhyate Daiva.
Yatha Dukam Ayatnaha.
Yatha Dukam Ayatnaha.
Sukham Indriyakam Daitya.
Sukham Indriyakam Daitya.
Deha Yogena Dehina.
Deha Yogena Dehina.
Sarvacha Labhyate Daiva.
Sarvacha Labhyate Daiva.
Yatha Dukam Ayatnata.
Yatha Dukam Ayatnata.
Sukham Indriyakam Daitya.
Sukham Indriyakam Daitya.
Deha Yogena Dehina.
Deha Yogena Dehina.
Sarvatra Labhyate Daiva.
Sarvatra Labhyate Daiva.
Yatha Dukam Ayatnata.
Yatha Dukam Ayatnata. Sukham Indriyakam Daitya.
Deha Yogena Dehina.
Deha Yogena Dehina.
Sarvatra Labhyate Daiva.
Sarvatra Labhyate Daiva.
Yatha Dukam Ayatnata.
Yatha Dukam Ayatnata. Sukhamaityakambhajya Deha yogena dehinam Sarvachala vichya daiva Yadukamayaknata Sukhamaityakambhajya Deha yogena dehinam
with reference to the material senses. Daitya, oh my dear friends born in demoniac families. Deha yogena, because of possessing a particular type of material body. Dehinam,
of all embodied living entities.
Sarvatra,
everywhere.
In any form of life. Labhyate is unobtained. Is obtainable. Daivat
by a
superior arrangement.
Yatha
just as.
Dukam
unhappiness. Ayatnata
without endeavor.
Translation. Prahlad Maharaj continues. My dear friends, born of demoniac families, the happiness perceived with reference to the sense objects by contact with the body can be obtained in any form of life, according to one's past fruitive activities. Such happiness is automatically obtained without endeavor, just as we obtain distress. Purport. In the material world, in any form of life, there is some so-called happiness and so-called distress. No one invites distress in order to suffer, but still it comes. Similarly, even if we do not endeavor to obtain the advantages of material happiness, we shall obtain them automatically. This happiness and distress are obtainable in any form of life without endeavor. Thus, there is no need to waste time and energy fighting against distress or working very hard for happiness. Our only business in the human form of life should be to revive our relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead and thus become qualified to return home back to Godhead. Material happiness and distress come as soon as we accept a material body, regardless of what form. We cannot avoid such happiness and distress under any circumstances. The best use of human life, therefore, lies in... reviving our relationship with the Supreme Lord Vishnu. Om Agana Timidandasya Ganjana Shalakaya Chakshu Militamina Tasmai Shri Guru Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. First had contact with this verse in the unfortunate, most unnecessary and excruciating experience known as material existence. I was wandering throughout the illusory world searching for imaginary happiness. And some other, I contacted a book, a small book by Srila Prabhupada called The Transcendental Teachings of Prahlad Maharaj. And within minutes after contacting this transcendental literature, I started reading it. And this is what I got to, Srila Prabhupada's paraphrase of his verse, on about page 2 or 3 of this small book. And reading it, for me, felt like being hit with a nuclear warhead that landed on my head. Oh my God, I'm struggling so hard just to get things that are available in any species of life. Srila Prabhupada very mercifully revved things up and added, gave his usually specially enriched renditions of the verse. What does it mean that you can get the happiness perceived in relation to sense objects in the body? You can get that in any species of life. Cats, dogs, he enumerated, pigs. I'm struggling so hard to get the same thing the cats and dogs and pigs get automatically. And I'm supposed to be educated, I'm supposed to be experienced, I'm supposed to be not only a New Yorker, but a Manhattan dweller. Ultra sophisticated, ultra cosmopolitan, and look at me. I just dropped the book and just collapsed on the couch. And I made up my mind. Tomorrow I'm going to Greenwich Village to find another book by this Swami whose name I can't pronounce. Srila Prabhupada explained that sensory education is all about rasa, taste. We've discussed this previously. Everyone wants a particular taste from all their activities. This is also described in Nectar of Devotion in the introduction. It's this taste, this rasa that drives you onward. You want a taste from relationships. You want an emotional taste. You want a physical taste. You want a taste you get from having possessions. This is mine. You want a taste from identifying with your home, your neighborhood, your society, or even you want a humanistic taste, identifying with all human beings. It's always taste, rasa, that we are pursuing. So what devastated me about this verse spoken by Prahlad Maharaj? Srila Prabhupada's deep penetration into this verse. The taste that you get from sense gratification as a human being can be had by the dogs and pigs. I felt so devastated. The taste is the same, though the circumstances are different and the body is different. The taste is the same. Think about it. Or don't think about it if you choose. It's quite embarrassing. This requires contemplation, as the Python Man said. I'm laying here thinking about these things. I've thought about it, and this is my conclusion, he told Prahlad Maharaj. What are the implications of this kind of knowledge? This is revolutionary. The taste of sense gratification is the same in any species of life. In other words, why work so hard to get the same flavors that the pigs and dogs are getting? It's embarrassing. So first of all, you have in your mind this imaginary happiness you hope to get in the future. Meanwhile, according to your particular type of body, and if you're a human being, it's karma. Your things are happening to your psychophysical existence that are brought to you automatically by time. So we're really hung up. We've got imaginary things, concocted things in our mind, and then we've got things happening to our body and mind due to chained victimization, due to things, lifetimes in the past. And none of this has anything to do with the spirit soul or devotional service to Krishna. We are truly lost in a dream world. Yet we think we're so practical. I know me, believe me. I know what I need. I know what I want. I know what's good for me. We spoke yesterday about miswanting, this new scientific term, describing human civilization as a bunch of miswanters. Let's go over this purport and think about very deep points. In the material world, in any form of life, there is some so-called happiness and so-called distress. Any form of life, there's happiness or distress? How can that be for the plants, for the animals, for the insects? Yes, they have a particular type of happiness and distress based on their body. Body means senses. Described yesterday, Indriyani Pranyo. The body is a bag of senses. So, as explained in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, every living entity taking the next birth receives a particular type of body. That means particular type of senses grouped around the mind. So never mind what type of body you have, you get a particular type of happiness and distress according to that body. How to convey this? I thought of a good example. When we were driving here, I was looking at the sky and noting that it's trying to rain. According to the weather report, it's supposed to rain heavily today and tomorrow, and then that's it, for the most part, except a few little sprinkles. So if you're in anxiety about the weather, I thought I'd tell you that. Today and tomorrow is supposed to be a bit windy and rainy, but then it's smooth sailing from then on. So Gokularanjan replied, oh, that's good. That's very good. But then think if you're a vegetable. Think if you're a fruit tree. I got that vision by talking with Krishna Prasad and Radha Prasad yesterday. I asked Radha Prasad, do you think it's going to rain? She says, I don't know. Ask Krishna Prasad. He's better at predicting the weather. So I asked Krishna Prasad, He said, well, you know, it's hard to say. These weather patterns around here are very confusing because if you know anything about weather, there are different fronts that are colliding and they produce unpredictable situations and microclimates. So, I said, yeah, but we could use some rain, you know. We, meaning he's identifying with the veggies that he's growing. That's his service. We could use some rain. He's actually feeling himself to be a plant. For Krishna's service. It sure would be nice if we got some rain. He's actually feeling like he's a lettuce or a zucchini. And feeling the happiness and distress of that particular form of life. I said, well, Krishna Prasad, it's already rained enough, hasn't it? He said, yeah, but try to understand that because there's so much wind in the air, it dries out the moisture on the ground. And then because the temperature is high, also, that causes the moisture to dry up. So he had it all down, how a plant feels happiness and distress. So what's good for one species of life, no rain, wonderful, is distress for another species of life. It's all in accordance with the type of body you have. If we think about these things, we can avoid being victimized in that chain of victimization. This next point is tough for people born in the Western world. It's a point that, up until India's economic boom, the Western world always accused India of illusion in this department. Fatalism. You think that everything comes to you by your karma. You don't endeavor. That's why India is backwards. They used to say like that before their corporations filled up with Indian IT personnel. So, the idea that you don't have to try for happiness, it comes automatically? Think about it. Does that really sit right with you? Even those whose bodies are from India. Think about it. Be honest. Are you really going to be content basing your life on this reality that your happiness and distress will come to you automatically without endeavor? Yeah, I see head shaking. No way. We've got to get it. We've got to go out there and get it. So listen to this transcendental conclusion. Thus, there is no need to waste time and energy fighting against distress are working very hard for happiness. A waste of time and energy? Working hard for happiness or fighting against distress? Isn't that what life is all about? What are you going to do if you don't do these things? What are you going to do if you don't fight off distress and try to get happiness? What's left in life? So for the Western world especially, and India in its current condition of economic boom, this is very radical. Is this axiom an invitation for lethargy? Not at all. As the purport continues, our only business in the human form of life should be to revive our relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead and thus become qualified to return home back to Godhead. We have something else to do, which is outside of the realm of karma and how it unloads your particular dose of happiness and distress upon you. Or, looked at another way, that dose of happiness and distress is packed into your body at the time of birth. If you check the weather report, they'll predict. Today is 35 millimeters of rain. Tomorrow is 32 millimeters of rain. They're predicting the dose of rain that's supposed to enter into your life as a human being. Similarly, there's a dose of happiness and distress that's going to rain into your life due to your past activities in the chain of victimization. Let's continue about this very radical point. Material happiness and distress come as soon as we accept a material body, regardless of its form. In other words, you're not doing anything new feeling happiness and distress. The plants do it, the pigs do it, the birds do it in their own way. Since you cannot avoid this happiness and distress materially, the best use of human life, therefore, is to get out of this cycle, get out of this matrix of illusion by rendering transcendental loving service to the Lord. This is bhakti yoga. The foremost jewel of activity. Not lethargy, but activity. Whether you're on the material platform or the spiritual platform, you're going to use your senses. Sometimes there's this fear that the more I get involved with bhakti yoga, the less I'll have to do with my senses and for my senses. This is material propaganda implanted in your mind by the illusory energy. Fear Krishna. Fear devotional service. You stop trying to please your own senses. What are you going to do then? You're just going to believe in God? And we know that's been out long ago in New Zealand especially. I mean, I'm just going to sit around and be a true believer? Even in India, the younger generation fears being a true believer. They've heard enough Mahabharata stories and the sensory world of bhakti yoga. This is our mainstay. Using the senses for Krishna's pleasure turns out to be far more rewarding than using our senses for material sense gratification. In serving Krishna, there is sense gratification, but it's all Krishna's sense gratification. And we need to get over our resentment of that principle. The resentment manifests in terms of our thinking, what's in it for me? Okay, Krishna's getting his. You look around, those who are vigorously participating in the kirtan, they're giving Krishna his due. They're chanting his name. What about me, though? What do I get from all this? We spoke briefly yesterday, and we may speak more about it in the future, about the standard of happiness in Vrindavan, in which no one tries to be happy. They simply think of Krishna's pleasure. Meanwhile, Krishna's busy forcing spiritual happiness on everyone, even though they don't think about it. And the devotees enjoy more than Krishna when seen from an objective point of view. The servant enjoys more than the master. Sometimes it's said equally, but then deeper understanding is more than the master. Of course, you know how Krishna resolves that situation. Okay, the bhaktas enjoy more than the Lord. I'll come as a bhakta. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I'll taste what the best devotees are tasting. So in that way, Krishna is still the supreme enjoyer. But just see how the bhakti system unfolds. The devotees enjoy more than Krishna. So why are we envious of Krishna then? Why are we so resentful and hesitant? There's some craziness embedded in our mind, which can be eradicated by attentive chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, hearing Bhagavatam class in association with devotees, and rendering selfless service to Krishna. You get over it. Our bhakti program in the beginning phases is basically about getting over it, getting over this resentment and fear of Krishna, this feeling that I'm entering into a void by leaving behind material sense gratification and selfishness. How can I be sure? We're implanting material anxiety into bhakti. Reminds me, sometimes I hear, I don't mention names, sometimes I hear, well, I'm happy with this person. I'm happy with my partner now, but how do I know how I'll feel 5 years from now? There's anxiety when you materially analyze like that. And we put that same anxiety-ridden analysis upon bhakti. Okay, I'm feeling pretty good in bhakti now, but how do I know I'm going to feel this way 5 years from now? The best indication that you'll make progress in bhakti in the future is that you're making progress now. Yadubar Pagurva Shaka Maharaji, who presented Prabhupada's quip that even if you think there's no God, still the bhakti lifestyle is better. So if you have any atheists out there, still this lifestyle is better. You should do it. Any atheists there? Raise your hand. Oh! Thank you for your honesty. Zeva's mother raised her hand. Meanwhile, I notice how she's so nicely dancing in kirtan. All right. Go on being an atheist. Just chant and dance in the kirtan. It'll all work out, I assure you. Yes, she's nodding her head. Yes, yes, I'm sure it will. You can talk to Vishakha Mataji. She was an expert atheist. I think at least in New Zealand, most persons don't even think whether I'm an atheist or not. Who cares? It's just not relevant, you know? Where's the sense gratification? So I hope you please think about this point deeply. Our theme, our overarching theme today is time is on the side of the lazy intelligent. So these instructions by Prahlad Maharaj are teaching you how to be lazy intelligent, and that is the best way to go. Lazy intelligent means to understand these things. I don't have to endeavor for happiness. I certainly don't endeavor for distress. It still comes to me. So let me use my valuable human form of life to make spiritual advancement, using my senses for Krishna's pleasure. That's why I told you that story of my own experience. This is a devastating point. I had gone to the pinnacle. I had received the pinnacle of material education since the age of 13. And when I read this verse, I just recognized, this is the king of knowledge. During my university days, my first year of four, I told my dean of studies, is that you call them that here, or is it? I said, I want to find the best knowledge. I don't want to be restricted to just having to study one foreign language course, one English literature course, one mathematics course, one science course. I said, just leave me alone. Let me take whatever courses I want. I got to find the best knowledge. So The university staff told me, oh, you're very brave. We wish we could have actually done such a thing when we were students. But, all right, we'll drop all the distribution requirements, and you can just plunder the university as you like. And we'll just cobble together your major somehow or other. Don't worry about it. Actually, this is what the university is for. We're glad someone's finally realized it. So I did that for 4 years. In the end, I was just completely disappointed. Not only in the end, but in the middle. After the first year of four, I already figured out. No one knows what they're talking about. I used to talk to some of my professors, world-class professors, who write the books that are studied in other universities. And I would just ask them, you know, does anyone really know what they're talking about? And they would kind of just look away. A few of them even told me, look, for the next paper assignment, you just write what you think, and we'll read it, and maybe we'll figure out something from it. And then, wait a minute, I'm a student. I'm a good teacher. I remember my final year of four. I was so dried out from material knowledge and at the same time convinced there was something more. But I remember on Fridays, when there are no more classes for the weekend, I would just go to the bookshop where they have comic books. And back then they had, I don't know what they have now, but they had these comic books called Strange Worlds or Other Worlds. And just to get some relief, to read that there's something else going on beyond what people think is the all-in-all on Earth. Remember those?
I never read them.
You remember they existed?
Yeah.
Just science. Basically, they were science fiction comic books. Just to get my mind off of the mundane politics and social sciences and psychology and all that kind of thing. Of course, what I was reading was mundane, but it was a vague, groping attempt to just try to get out of the box. So when I, upon graduation, saw this verse by Prahlad Maharaj, I immediately recognized, this is it. This is the topmost knowledge. I kept reading further. It was just a small book. And as I've explained perhaps before, because living in Manhattan, you're always going to music clubs and theater, and you're seeing the best of the world in terms of the performing arts. And so then, especially at various jazz clubs or salsa clubs. Most of you don't know what that is, I think. So, anyway, it's the New York ultra-sophisticated life. So when the musician is really getting into it, then the crowd calls out to encourage the musician. So back then we used to call out to the musician, work your show! Work your show! That was kind of the slang back then for, saying, do it, get into it. So I was reading this book by Srila Prabhupada, Translations of Prahlad Maharaj, and I just started spontaneously calling out, work your show, Swami, work your show. Couldn't pronounce his name, so I was just calling Swami, work your show, Swami, do it. My intelligence and heart were totally touched by it. I'd never seen you. I read anything like that, where someone could just cut right to the heart of everything. And I immediately recognized, after years of most high-powered education in the world, I recognized, this is real knowledge. He knows what he's talking about. As Yadavar Prabhu was saying when he talked to a devotee, when he went to do a report or a project on how the Hare Krishnas live, he said, I never heard a person so convinced. I never met a person who was so convinced. So, and that was just from meeting a disciple of Srila Prabhupada. Here I was reading Prabhupada's words, and I said, in all my years, since the age of 13, actually, why the age of 13? My mother taught me how to read when I was 4, and I just started reading anything I could get my hands on. She told me when I was a little baby, I used to keep trying to crawl to bookshelves and grab books off the shelf. So all those years, I had never come across anyone who spoke so deeply and authoritatively. So even to this day, I can read this same verse and its purport, and I'm astonished. So I hope you'll take this very seriously and think about it. You can really save yourself a lot of trouble, especially in these days of sensual overload, which is really affecting our devotees. They're coming from that background, and it's all around them. It disturbs all the ashrams. So if you can use your scientific intelligence to understand this, or use your common sense intelligence to understand this, you'll save yourself so much trouble. Let's go to the next verse. This is also spoken by Prahlad Maharaj. Prahlad Maharaj is saving us so much trouble. And he's speaking as a 5-year-old. Sukhaya dukkha mokshaya.
Sukhaya dukkha mokshaya.
Sankalpa iha karmana.
Sankalpa iha karmana.
Sadapnoti haya dukkham.
Sadapnoti haya dukkham.
Anihaya sukhavrita.
Anihaya sukhavrita.
Sukhaya dukkha mokshaya.
Sukhaya dukkha mokshaya.
Ah, once enough. Very enthusiastic. Translation. In this material world, every materialist desires to achieve happiness and diminish his distress, and therefore he acts accordingly. Actually, however, one is happy as long as one does not endeavor for happiness. And as soon as one begins his activities for happiness, his conditions of distress begin. This is really radical, isn't it? Better not read this kind of thing, huh? Work hard, get money, or just lose yourself in the cloud land of drugs, or just dive deep into sensuality, but to open this book and read it? Purport. Well, we'll just give you some extracts from purport. We need the whole purport generally of the main verse for today. Prahlad is presenting the psychology of material existence better than any, infinitely better than any mundane psychologist could present. If you see your life as having that mission, your material life, I'm going to get happiness. Just see yourself clutching it, bringing it to yourself. All that exertion, that energy. Try to see your material endeavors in that way. And then, of course, meanwhile, you've got to battle off the distress. Such a preoccupation, right? And then we hear Prahlad saying, you're actually happy as long as you don't endeavor for happiness. Because as soon as you begin your activities for happiness, mark it. Mark the spot. Draw the line. That's where your conditions of distress begin. In other words, as soon as you try to endeavor materially, you get caught in the web of material existence, and the complications just continue. The chained victimization. It's a very sticky situation. As soon as you endeavor, you're further entangled. And you just make things worse. But what is the standard of so-called rationality these days? Even though I don't know what the world is or who I am, and even though I don't fully see the implications of what I'm doing, let me tell you, right now, I think I feel good. That's the standard. That means animal life. That is the verdict of the Acharyas about our celebrated lifestyles, material lifestyles these days. Animal life. No one wants to think that, though. Let me read you a sentence from the purport, which if you think about it, quite revolutionary. The body is just like an instrument by which the living entity moves according to false desires for happiness. Now, I want you to feel that. I've got this instrument, and I'm moving it. I'm moving it because I've got these false desires for happiness. Now, some of you might be thinking, well, if every time we move our body, we start thinking this, what are we going to get done in the world? This is an instrument that I move. It's like this microphone, you move it, or an iPhone, you manipulate it. So similar, this body is an instrument also. You see Zeba there at the controls of the sound system. He's moving knobs and dials and plugging in things and unplugging things. The body is just like that. It's an instrument that you're moving because in the mind are false desires for happiness. So you're using the body as an instrument to achieve those illusions. So Prahlad is saying, mark it down, draw the line. As soon as you make one move, even in your mind, in the plan-making stage, mark it. That's where the distress begins. Okay, now fight back. It can't be like that, really. It's not so bad, right? I mean, really, it's just natural. Are the Hare Krishnas against just natural living? Why are they trying to make life so uptight? This is very deep knowledge. All your activities begin with some kind of plan or ambition. Even your spiritual activities, the plan to please Krishna, the ambition to please Krishna. And your material activities. I'm going to get for me. Not only for me, I'm not selfish, but those who are favorable to my body and mind, I'm going to get for them also. And they'll appreciate me. They'll appreciate my mind, and life will be better. So Prahlad is saying, as soon as you start making plans, remember the Manodharma factory, that factory of making plans rather than accepting Krishna's plan. The distress begins in that factory. Sometimes devotees, they get troubled due to weak spiritual practices, and their mind becomes so afflicted. They don't know what to do with the mind. It's just harassing them. It's because that factory is producing. The workers are working overtime. There are plans going on in that mind. There are ambitions being manufactured in that factory. And there's a little fear. If I shut that factory down, what will become of me? Because there's not adequate attention being paid to rebuilding the factory that produces Krishna's plans. Krishna's plans are eternal. Just like, actually, the knowledge of the Vedas is eternal. Veda Narayana Sakshat. You'll read in the sixth canto of Bhagavatam. Just as the breathing of Narayana is eternal, similarly, the Vedas are eternal because the Vedas are breathed out by Narayana. Skeptics may say, oh, that's just mythology. Just because your breathing isn't eternal in this body. Conditioned life, conditioned living entities are the real myth. So the Bhagavatam turns the table on the myth of material existence. And we have to fight back by, no, Krishna's the myth, Bhakti's the myth. We, material life, well, it may not be so great, but it's the real thing. We're so proud. Proud of what? Proud of working hard to get the same rasa, the same taste that the dogs and pigs get. To further solidify this point in my intelligence, that's the practice of Buddhi Yoga, using your intelligence to assimilate Bhagavatam. Some of you may remember, maybe about 10 or 11, 12 years ago, sometimes I think of doing it again. Whenever I was in a city, I would go to the zoo. I would study the animals and think, what taste are they getting? And how is that different from the taste that I was getting in material life? Very interesting. I remember I was in Melbourne, so Aniruddha Prabhu and some other devotees, they went with me to the Melbourne Zoo. It's bigger than the zoos that are in New Zealand. This is a zoo in Wellington, a bigger one in Auckland. The Melbourne Zoo is bigger. So he used to be, before he took up devotional activities, he worked in a zoo, taking care of the animals as one of his jobs. So he was telling me as we were driving there, actually animals are very sensitive. They actually can feel human intentions, some of them. So I didn't think much of it. You know, I was just thinking of this verse from Bhagavatam. So we were taking a tour of the zoo, and we got to this big cave, enclosed area where the baboons lived. Have any of you ever seen a baboon? Strange looking creatures to human eyes, right? So the baboons were there, and they were scratching and crawling around like baboons, and I just spontaneously burst out laughing. And then, to my amazement, the baboon picked up a piece of a branch and threw it at me. Of course, the piece of wood couldn't go through the cage, but nevertheless, he tried his best. He just... Well, Aniruddha Prabhu said, I told you that animals are sensitive. So my point is that I was really trying to see through the eyes of Bhagavatam and not just read these verses, so to speak, with the surface of our eyes. Okay, we are devotees, we are practicing bhakti yoga, we have to read Srimad Bhagavatam every day. Okay, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. I have mechanically chanted my rounds. No one will get on my case for not, getting rid of my rounds. I have turned the pages of the Bhagavatam. I'm doing everything formally and mechanically, but I still expect the complete result of the Bhakti Yoga system that Krishna promises. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to experience the Bhagavatam with every ounce of my being. That's why I was very interested in this book, Vishakha Mataji's illustrated Bhagavad Gita, I was interested in the pictures because I was interested in how the pictures that her husband and her took, how they would bring out the Bhagavad Gita. Because people are very visual these days. And they need visual things to fix points in their mind due to overload by TV and movies. And so when I went to the zoo, I was trying to visually overload my intelligence with seeing what matched the Bhagavatam. We're hearing more and more information that don't endeavor for happiness. It comes automatically. And Prahlad, and how are you going to argue at this point? A point the Vaishnavacharyas will often raise. How many of you endeavor for distress? Anyone here endeavor for distress? Raise your hand. Anyone? Persons from so many different countries. USA, New Zealand, Australia, India, Argentina, Moldova. I don't know where Moldova is, except for Sasha. Have you ever endeavored for distress? I'm really going to work at being miserable today. Of course not. But still the distress comes. Okay, you can bring up the point of masochists. But they're actually not endeavoring for distress. They're endeavoring for pleasure. They get pleasure out of feeling pain. I know it's hard for you to understand, but such persons exist. I was once at a Krishna center in Copenhagen, Denmark. And Copenhagen used to be famous as a place in Europe, like Amsterdam, where anything goes. But now the whole world's like that. So there was a knock on the door of the center, and I opened it, and there was a nice, quote-unquote, normal-looking, middle-aged man and woman. And they very cordially and very nicely introduced themselves. Good morning. We're just here to introduce ourselves. We're your local representatives of the Masochist Club. And we're just here to let you know that we're here for you. I said, excuse me, but I think I'm interested. But they did it so matter of factly. And they look respectable and they were respectable, competent persons. We're just here to let you know that the Masochist Club exists for your needs. We are here for you. So, okay, they're endeavoring for distress, someone else would say, but no, they're actually endeavoring for pleasure. By someone inflicting pain, they feel pleasure. It's weird, but so it's not that they're actually endeavoring for distress. So we have the point established that no one endeavors for distress. Yet how many of you have felt distress before? Yes, but you didn't endeavor for it. Think about it. So Prahlad's point is, similarly, you don't have to endeavor for happiness. It'll come, just like distress does, whether you endeavor for it or not. We hear this again and again, and there's something rebellious that rises up in us. Nah, nah, nah. It can't really be like that. Because if you don't endeavor for happiness, what are you going to do? Even though it's so obvious, I don't endeavor for distress, yet I get distressed. We feel duty-bound to endeavor for happiness. You can only get out of this trap by hearing in the association of realized souls. This is how intense Maya is. You hear it, and it makes sense. It's so obvious. But then You just gotta do what you gotta do, you know? I mean, yeah. Bhagavatam class is over and the real world's out there. And the bhakti yogi wants to live according to Bhagavatam. That is the most exalted status of life. There's information in Bhagavatam so that all the ashramas can be perfected. Bhagavatam is known as Paramahansa Samhita. It's the Samhita. It's the treatise for swan-like persons of any ashram. This information, how grihasthas, brahmacharis, sannyasis, everyone can live and attain the highest standard of life. You have to work at it, though. It's the real career. So when you stop foolishly endeavoring to get material happiness and fight material distress, you have the energy and focus for your real career. Applying Srimad Bhagavatam. But if we don't even have time to read Srimad Bhagavatam, something's wrong. The bhakti life means dedication to devotional service. For those of you who are contemplating such, or who are fortunately already doing that, a dedicated life to service, according to your ashram style. The style varies according to your ashram. You've seen in Yadavaparu and Vishaka Maji, they don't endeavor in my style, I don't endeavor in their style, but it's within the house of bhakti. The whole point is dedication to the service of the Lord. For those of you who want to be that way, or who are fortunately humbly tasting that rare dimension of life, listen to this. The bhakti yogi is not at all angry even when attempts are unsuccessful. Oh, what kind of stuff is this? I mean, success. Okay, if we can't have success in material life, we should have success as materially measured in spiritual life. That means, for example, if Yadavaprabhu makes a film, it should be materially evaluated as a success. I mean, it should sell, you know, thousands or millions of copies, and that's how you evaluate whether the endeavor was successful or not. Not exactly. The bhakti analysis is much more rich than that. The bottom line of evaluating the endeavor is the pleasure of the devotee, the pleasure of Krishna. Pleasing Krishna's devotee, pleasing Krishna. That's the real measure of success. So bhakti is a bit more deep than just statistical analyses. Who is a big devotee? A big devotee is simply someone who pleases Krishna's devotee. And that way Krishna is pleased. Let us not succumb to the view that to do big service and be a big devotee, you have to have some big title. You have to do something that everyone recognizes is huge with global impact. That would be nice, but that's not the only criterion for big service. The actual main criterion is simply, does Krishna get pleasure from your service? Does Krishna's devotee get pleasure from your service? Sometimes recognition follows that and sometimes not. Look at Ram Leela, Jatayu. From the material point of view, he's a complete failure, right? You know, Ravana was kidnapping Sita, and Jatayu, the bird devotee, fought Ravana unsuccessfully, and Ravana mortally wounded him. And Jatayu lay on the ground dying, and when Ramchandra, Lord Ramchandra came, J- Jatayu told with his dying breaths, Sita's been kidnapped by Ravana. And then he died. He couldn't stop Ravana. He couldn't save his life. But Lord Ramchandra performed his funeral ceremony. So from the material point of view, it's failure. From the spiritual point of view, it's the greatest success. One day I may share with you a very powerful, probably my closest, most intimate experience of Srila Prabhupada since his departure, in a circumstance of complete material failure. And I was totally astonished. It's just obvious this is failure. But the transcendental devotees of the Lord took it another way. They looked at the effort, the motivation. So this is real bhakti in the big leagues. They don't use that expression in New Zealand. They're really small here. In the Super League. Everyone's rugby mad here, so. Srila Prabhupada writes, consequently, he is not at all angry, even when his attempts are unsuccessful. Success or no success, a Krishna conscious person is always steady in his determination. This is a point that everyone remembers about Jayananda Prabhu. He had no title. He wasn't a sannyasi. He wasn't even a temple president. Yet he just worked humbly and dedicatedly. And in that way, his pleasing of the devotees, his pleasing of the spiritual master, has been commemorated. Devotees remember his selfless service, and that imprinted their hearts more than any someone carrying a title. He tried to help whoever was around him. Whoever was around him, he tried to help and encourage in devotional service. His life was dedicated to devotional service, especially to Rathayatras. Even in the most infirm condition, Keshava Bharati Maharaj was telling me how he was in San Francisco with Jayananda Prabhu, and as usual, Jayananda Prabhu was working night and day preparing for Rathayatra. Keshava Bharati Maharaj, was a Brahmacharya, that he noticed that Jayananda Prabhu was after it was like 11 o'clock at night, after a day of intense labor, he was drooping a bit more than normal. So he asked him, what's going on? How are you? So Jayananda Prabhu told him, I'll only tell you if you promise not to reveal this to anyone until after the Rathayatra. So Keshava Bharati Maharaj promised, and then Jayananda Prabhu lifted up both arms, and in the armpits there are these big lumps. He had leukemia, but he didn't want anyone to know until after the Rathayatra, so he could give his all in all. As you read in this purport, success or no success, a Krishna conscious person is always steady in his determination. That's real love. And this is what the core of our being is longing for, real love. Let's go to our next Bhagavatam verse. Yeah. Tasyai veheto priyate ta kovido. Tasyai veheto priyate ta kovido nalabhyateya brahmatam upayada talabhyate dukavat anyata sukham kalena sarvacha gabhira ranhasa. This is, I believe it's Narada Muni speaking. Persons who are actually intelligent and philosophically inclined should endeavor only for that purposeful end which is not obtainable, even by wandering from the topmost planet, Brahmaloka, down to the lowest planet, Patala. As far as happiness derived from sense enjoyment is concerned, it can be obtained automatically in course of time, just as in course of time we obtain miseries even though we do not desire them. Prahlad Maharaj was focusing on the body and how the body automatically brings different types of happiness and distress. As soon as you take on a body, the body is packed with your correct dosage of psychophysical feelings of happiness and distress. It's your karma. Now, here in the first canon of Bhagavatam, we are learning that time is not just tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. Time's bringing you things. It's bringing your happiness and distress. Or looked at another way, time is bringing out that happiness and distress that's packed already into your body and mind. Therefore, as we've often explained, there's no such thing as an innocent child. The child's body is just waiting for time to bring out the seeds of karma and desire already in the body. As you all can remember, how peaceful life was in many ways before you were 12 or 13. And then when 12 or 13 came and the hormones changed, your whole worldview changed. Kalena sarvatra gabhira ramhasa. In the course of time. We look at the purport and we find so many jewels to meditate upon. I'll read you a few that I've found striking. I'll read again tomorrow and I'll find something else striking. That's the glory of Prabhupada's books. They're spiritual books. You think you've got all the juice you can get out of one purport, look at it again in the future. Oh, look at that. So listen to this. The philosophically inclined person must not be tempted by such changeable positions. Life as a presentation of changeable conditions, as a sequence or experience of changeable positions. Someone intelligent should be tempted by all that. It's adjusting, the Vaishnavacharyas would call it. Let me adjust my way out of material distress and adjust my way into happiness. I'll just make this adjustment, that adjustment. I'll change jobs, I'll change wives, I'll change schools, I'll change homes, and some or other. I'll adjust my way to happiness. Okay? All I have to do is this, all I have to do is that. I'm feeling a bit bored and unfulfilled. That's it, the word these days, unfulfilled. What does that mean? Time for an adjustment. Who would disagree with that? So you see, especially in Kali Yuga at this point, such rapid adjustments going on, like at a pace that's never happened before. And an intelligent person can understand, society is crumbling because human beings can't endure under such a load of constant change and adjustment. It's become so frantic these days. Human beings are they're cracking. I meant to tell you yesterday, let's just take a country like the USA. New Zealanders like to beat up on the USA. That's why Yadavarpa Guru and Vishaka Maji moved from the USA to Canada, so now they can beat up on the USA also. Everyone's kicking Sam. So, the economy in 50 years before the crash of 2008, the gross domestic product, whether you know about that or not, don't worry about it. But in any case, roughly speaking, the economy has tripled. Meanwhile, the amount of mental depression has increased tenfold, especially among children. People are cracking up. They're hyped to just adjust. You see this on TV, you hear that on the radio, you see that on the internet. You all are aware of the hyper-communication system. Social networking. Human beings can't handle such a load. They're actually cracking up. This notion that you can adjust your way out of material happiness and distress is a complete failure. Look at the results. Whether as an individual, as a society, or as humanity, you can't adjust your way out of it. There's only the illusion, the imagination that you can do so. That's all you get is imagination. As I explained to so many young persons who are approaching bhakti, trying to deal with life as they live it. All right, you drop this girlfriend and pick up another. You're adjusting. Are you really going to become happy and fulfilled in that way? The example the Vaishnava Acharyas give is you have a burden on one shoulder, and you think, it'll be so much progress if I put the burden on the other shoulder. Now this shoulder's feeling relief. Doesn't that feel good? Meanwhile, the intelligent person, of course, points out, hey, you just transferred the burden on the other shoulder. Very shortly, the other shoulder's going to feel pain. And then, as a brilliant person of Kali Yuga, what do you say? Okay, when that shoulder feels pain, I'll just transfer the burden back to the original shoulder. Progress! No one wants to get to the root of why should you be carrying burdens? Huh? That's why Prahlad Maharaj, again, our hero Prahlad Maharaj says, Maya Sukhaya Bhadam Udvahato Vimudan, carrying a false burden. Maya Sukhaya, the false burden of imaginary happiness. It's not a real burden. It's bad enough to carry a real burden, but just think, a fool suffers under an imaginary burden. So, this imaginary burden is what the social scientists are starting to understand, but they can't get out of it. They themselves admit, we can't change our behavior. Some of you can remember in preceding years, I discussed the science of romance as known by material science and as known by the Bhagavatam. That was a popular one. And I explained how scientists have calculated the worldwide average for the duration of romantic feelings. Everything, all these statistical analyses are possible because of computers. And I know everyone remembers what the worldwide average was. I know because often devotees, they come up and tell me, Well, Maharaj, I guess we hit that point, you know, in the world average. You know what it is? 17 months. For 17 months, on the average, you're flying. And then, in terms of romantic feelings. Hopefully, a Krishna conscious relationship is much more than that. But in terms of those traditional psychophysical romantic feelings, the average is 17 months. So, the scientists who are studying all this, they admit, even though we know all this data, still, we go through the same experiences ourselves. Even though we're night and day, this is our research. But still, things happen, you know, and what can we say? No one has an idea of a viable alternative. An alternative that actually makes sense and that can work. Bhakti, the bhakti lifestyle is that alternative. How to use your senses perfectly for the pleasure of the master of the senses. That in a nutshell is the definition of bhakti. So just think about how we victimize ourselves by trying to adjust. It's a disease. That romance has faded. Now time to find another one. That's just one example. If we can learn to see this tendency as a disease, we can save ourselves so much trouble. They don't teach you this in med school, do they? And when society does this as a whole, you just have a world of madness. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur gives a brilliant example. He said, material existence is like an ocean of suffering. Now let's say you gather all the human beings and tell them, we're going to scoop out that ocean. And they all the 6 billion human beings now, they start scooping out the water from the ocean of material suffering. And then at one point they actually do it. There's no more water in the ocean. And they're so proud. We did it! We did it! We finished off the ocean of material suffering. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur points out, wait a minute, what would you say? Huh?
Where's the water
go? So he points out, the water has to be moved somewhere else. You just change the problem from one ocean spot to another ocean spot. But meanwhile, you're taking pride. We did it! We emptied out the ocean! We human beings have scooped out all the water of suffering! Aren't we wonderful? But the Vaishnavacharya say, just hold it right there. Where'd the water go? You just transferred the problems from one place to another. Very lucid analysis. He would give examples like that because he was present during the time in India when the commotion for independence was there. And top leaders would come to see him. Top leaders of the Indian independence movement would come see him and say, why are you dosing everyone with bhakti when actually we need, you know, revolution? We need to get the British out. In fact, some of them would come to him and say, you know, look at all these young men you have in your brahmacharya ashram here in the mandir. These men should be leading the political revolution. And Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur would reply, oh, you can take whomever wants to go with you. Simply changing the ocean of suffering from one location to the other. When I was in Los Angeles last month, I gave an example from current events showing this foolishness. For decades in the USA, not only USA, Canada, Australia also, places where they have coal. It's not that much coal in New Zealand, is there? It's something, but it's not a big deal. But in these other countries, there's a lot of coal. So for decades, environmentalists have been hard at work trying to make sure that no more coal-fired electric power plants are constructed, because coal, fossil fuel, is a huge polluter, contributing to climate change, global warming, on and on and on it goes. Even just ordinary respiratory problems. For years, this struggle has been going on. Decades. Since the 70s. And that effort has reached success. Practically, the governments of these countries have halted any new coal-fired power plants. So the environmentalists were feeling, there's progress, at least we can do something. Not simply environmental activists, but people in the know in general who have some intelligence and realize that you can't screw up the world's atmosphere at the same time want to live there. Then guess what happened? All the coal is being exported to China. You got to make your money. Somehow or other, make money is the number one goal. Okay, no more coal-fired power plants in USA, Canada, Australia. Business has to go on. We'll follow the law and ship all the coal to China. And you know what happens when the coal is burned in China. It doesn't stay on the Earth planet. It goes somewhere else, right? So the world is saved. So now China is consuming half of the world's coal production. And then, how does the coal get from Canada or USA or Australia to China? Does it fly through the air? How does it get there? And how do the boats run on? What do they run on?
Oil.
So, the pollution is simply increased. Instead of the coal burning problem in USA, Canada, Australia, now they have created further environmental impact by shipping the coal, which pollutes for all those ships, burning fuel, and they're bringing the coal to China. Of course, it's in China, and who here lives in China? Anyone? One person, yes? Yeah? No? No one from China. And it's burning in China. That's another country. We're in New Zealand. It's so environmentally advanced. Coal burning in China. What's that got to do with the world? Isn't China another planet? So now the environmentalists are just, they're just whacking their heads. Oh. This is worse than before. Now we're not simply burning coal in power plants. We are also shipping the coal and polluting the atmosphere. And things are worse. So that was Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's response to the independence activists in India of the early 20th century. He said, okay, let's suppose you do kick the British out. Are you going to tell me that things are going to be better? Really? Just change the people running the government? Everything's going to be better? Are you really sure about that? He was very bold. Even now, to say such a thing in India, there's no difference, really, since the British left. This would be offended. Right, Thakur is around? We Indians can run our own country. Like every other country this world. As you dare say. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said. Calcutta's finest resident, Srila Prabhupada, also said it. What's the big deal? You kick the British out? You know, where's the big improvement? So you can imagine. Especially during the time preceding independence, when the political activity was fomenting. You can imagine what these activists were thinking of. Bhakti Siddhanta Sashi Thakur was so strong and bold, he wouldn't budge. Some of the activist leaders even went away thinking, oh, he's definitely a real sadhu. Some of them were impressed. We can't be like him. We can't act according to what he's saying, but he's definitely speaking the truth. Netaji Subhas Chandra Bose, he was like that. He appreciated. This is a real sadhu. I've seen so many fakers. This is the real thing. But I can't act in that way. I've got to raise an army, get rid of the British that way. So Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur's point was, raise an army or not, the situation won't change. You can't adjust your way materially out of material distress. Next to the last point. Miseries and mixed happiness are two features of material life. If you can see material existence in that way, there's always going to be misery and there's always going to be mixed happiness and never pure happiness. Perhaps you can remember trying to enjoy something, but there's always some anxiety in the back of your mind. This is going to end. So, like I was explaining, anxieties I often hear. I like my husband or wife now, but I wonder, how will I feel 5 years from now? This is a material approach to life, that even when you think you have an enjoyable situation now, there's anxiety based on the fact that everything material is temporary. Therefore, even the so-called happiness is mixed. No pure happiness. Pure happiness is available in the bhakti system. It's a career to become qualified to get that. But we're cheapskates. I've been chanting Hare Krishna for 2 years. Where's the pure bliss? It's like someone who's got some major illness and the doctor gives them the program for recuperating. I've been following this program for some months now. Where's my perfect health? Patience and determination is required. How do you evaluate happiness and distress amongst other persons? We read, the miseries and mixed happiness of all living beings are only of different degree and quality. No one is free from this affliction. No material bodies are free. Just different degrees and qualities of distress and mixed happiness. I saw this at the zoo. I was studying the apes. It's easy to see in apes, but more you can also see in other species. Be a more skillful eye. I saw some apes in the Auckland Zoo, and they were embracing and they were making lust. And I looked in their eyes, and I could see that they were tasting mixed happiness. I was just looking at them. They looked at me, they didn't care. What's your problem? You know, we've got important things to do. But I could see they're getting mixed happiness, which is available in any species of life. Prabhupada's advice, One should not, therefore, waste time with these flimsy things. Makes it sound like children, doesn't it? Child with a cheap toy, and an adult knows, what are you wasting time with? You know, such a cheap toy. They have these dollar shops in New Zealand now? Yes. They're there in the States, and they're doing a booming business these days because of the economic situation. But normally, you wouldn't go to a dollar shop. Any of you ever gone to a dollar shop? Excuse me. What were you looking for? What were you looking for?
Something
to
scrub the dishes with? Or
a hammer.
Why go to a dollar shop to get a hammer?
You don't use it often, just once,
that's why. Anyone else? What do you go to a dollar shop for? If somebody raised their hand.
Biro pen.
Huh?
Biro pen.
Cheap pen. Cheap pen. You really, you go to a dollar shop for that?
Yeah, something like that.
Huh? Wrapping paper.
Wrapping paper?
Okay, learn something every day. But as you all said, you don't expect the thing to last if you get it at a dollar shop. It's a flimsy thing. As Mantramala said, a hammer that you know you're only going to use once. It's kind of strange for men to hear that kind of thing. You know, a hammer, you know, you get a hammer that's going to last because you're always going to need a hammer. Two different worlds. Both have their justification.
Usually you use a hammer. You use a lot. Why would a woman only need one time?
Telling the Shaka Maji, they train me up here in New Zealand. All right. One should not, therefore, waste time with these flimsy things. Now, just think of happiness and distress in life as trinkets, flimsy trinkets, cheap stuff. Oh, that's different. This information is liberating, and this information establishes you in your original constitutional position, which means to feel the bhakti bhava, feeling yourself as a servant of Krishna. That's real life. We had some other points we were going to discuss today, but I think we'll stop there. Except for one thing. Can you get Bhagavad Gita 632 up? No, actually, I'll just read it. Some idea would be that look like, come on, Guru Maharaj, you can't do everything. I've also learned to see the facial expressions. I've become sensitive. There's a verse in Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 6, verse 32, where Krishna explains that the true yogi sees the true equality of all living beings, both in their happiness and distress. In other words, the true yogi can look at a particular living entity, and regardless of the packaging of happiness and distress that encases the living entity, the true yogi sees the equality. The true yogi is not fooled by the differing amounts and qualities of happiness and distress encasing a particular living entity. Therefore, a true yogi doesn't become envious. Your material situation is better. This makes for peaceful living. To see the equality of all living beings, regardless of the differing amounts and qualities of happiness and distress. You're not fooled. You're not fooled by the illusion that material happiness and distress are so intrinsic to the real self. Our next discussion will... I don't think I'm going to warn you. It's entitled, Got to Feel It. It is about the predominant form of happiness at this advanced stage of Kali Yuga. We're going to analyze the taste. But before that, you'll get a treat. You'll get relief from me, and tomorrow morning we'll be hearing Bhagavatam class from the Grace Vishakha Mataji. So then, we're going to get into an analysis of what hangs up conditioned souls. A particular kind of bhava, which is not bhakti bhava. A particular type of prison which has no bars. A prison that no one or very few persons want to escape. The barless prison that the prisoners choose to remain in voluntarily. And that voluntary imprisonment has a certain flavor. We'll look at Bhagavad Gita, we'll look at Prahlad Maharaj, we'll hear what the Python Man has to say, and hopefully we'll be able to make some advancement. All right. Thank you. Hare Krishna.